today on Against the Grain, conversations about theater and performance and history and ideas. I'm CS. We'll present highlights of interviews with a number of actors, directors, and other performers, sharing insights into what they do and why, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. I had a chance recently to go through an assortment of interviews I've done while wearing another hat, that of associate theater critic at the station where I'm based. Today we'll present highlights of those interviews, featuring actors and directors talking about what they do and how they do it, both the intellectual and creative work that goes into presenting plays, and the methods and mechanics of acting and directing. I've taken care to select highlights that don't depend on your seeing any of the particular plays or productions. What we offer this hour are comments and reflections that I think stand on their own, and that provide deep insight into theater making and storytelling, and in many cases, into people and social life and history and politics more generally. Our lineup includes the playwright and solo performer Nilaja Sun, Tom Ross, Artistic Director of Aurora Theatre Company in Berkeley, the actors Emily Jean Brown and Jackie Chung, the San Francisco Mime Troupe veteran Michael Jean Sullivan, the Theatre Arts Professor and Director Daryl V. Jones, Gregory Dawson, Artistic Director of Dawson Dance SF, and L. Peter Callender, Artistic Director of African American Shakespeare Company. We begin with portions of a conversation I had with Nilaja Sun, whose one-woman show Pike Street, set in New York City's Lower East Side, recently held sway at Berkeley Rep. Her show is about a group of people awaiting the arrival of a hurricane, and I asked Nilaja how she felt about judgments people sometimes and perhaps often make about people who, despite requests from local authorities, do not evacuate in advance of a hurricane or other major event.
Just even recently with the last hurricane, and also with the campfire, I have the sense that there is this reporting that happens with deceased people that kind of blame them for not leaving. And I noticed this really abruptly during Hurricane Katrina. And then the reporting, it just kept sustaining with this kind of narrative of, well, they didn't leave. So it's kind of like when someone dies in a car accident and they say, but they weren't wearing their seatbelt. Well, you didn't know if the seatbelt wasn't working. You don't know if they were trying to put their seatbelt on, if you know. I was always kind of ticked off by that kind of reporting because I felt like, especially with Katrina, just a lot of folks could not leave their home or would not leave their home because that's all they had. Imagine your whole entire life in one home. You've got your dogs, you've got your cats, you've got your parakeets. You know, you have your life here. And to go to the Astrodome or to go to a shelter where you know it's going to be full of people asking millions of questions, I think some people just choose to stick it out simply because they would rather die in their home than be emotionally triggered in a shelter.
Nilaja Sun plays 12 different characters in her show Pike Street. Here she emphasizes listening, her ability and willingness to listen, as the key to learning about people who sometimes show up in one way or another in her plays.
I am one of those people who, when I live my life, even though I'm living my life, I'm also kind of recording. So I hear accents, I hear tones of voice, I hear what's said and what's not said. I definitely watch people's body language. And so I'm kind of recording it, not necessarily to use in a show, but just in life, because it just feeds my soul to record folks. And so because I have spent so much of my life recording these people, I feel like it's almost my duty as an actor, as someone who loves physical theater, as someone who kind of has the clout to write a play and possibly have it be done at Berkeley Rep, to really represent these people who I feel like are invisible communities, or invisible people. And so that's really why I keep doing this work, to make sure that their lives were not in vain.
Now, you have said, and I think it might have been to a Berkeley Rep staffer, that you enjoy diving into the characters you portray and telling the truth within every soul. What does that mean to you, the truth within every soul?
There's something about when you meet someone and you get a chance to just listen to them, or even just listen to the silence that they hold and the silence around their body and how they hold the space in that silence, that feels like truth to me. It's very easy to yap away and use a bunch of words to kind of hide how you're feeling. But it is in these moments when Mother Nature is creeping in and lights are shutting on and off, and you kind of don't know what the next moment will hold. It's in the kind of silence and the breath that I feel the truth is.
Nalaja's son also talked about what she sees when she looks out into the audience from the stage.
When I perform, when I'm looking at the audience, I can see the body language of each audience member. And also I can kind of, in a way, see like light around the audience members. And what I find with in some places. Okay, so in D.C., I see a lot of light around people's heads. So I know that they're super smart, very intellectual. Everyone's thinking politically. What does this play mean politically? In New York, it's more out of the mouth, a lot of light out of the mouth and the kind of throat chakra. So there's a lot of laughter in New York and Pike Street. It's more like, that kind of laughter. In Australia, it's more, it's kind of an amorphous kind of light, whereas folks are just trying to figure out, okay, what are these accents? Where are these people from? And here in Berkeley, the light resides in your bellies. So folks are, I feel, they're hearing the play from their bellies and from where the creative center is.
And the light is also literal? You can see light?
Yeah, I actually can. Because what happens is that when you're on stage by yourself for many, many shows, you wind up seeing, instead of just the people, you see the shadows of the people. But more than anything, you see their personalities, even if they're at the tip top, the last seat, you still see their personality. And it's helped me in my teaching as well. So when I can walk into any classroom and just see the light. And then when I don't see the light coming out of a student, it usually means I have to really pay attention to them because they need extra care.
What's one thing you teach to students interested in solo performing? One thing that you teach that might, you know, surprise ordinary folks like me?
Okay, so here's one thing I teach. A lot of times my students will come up to me and say, how do you keep your attention span on the show? Because there are so many characters, there's so much to do. How do you keep it all tight? And I say, well, I try as much as I can to live in every moment. So I live in every moment when I'm off stage, so that then when I'm on stage, I am in every moment on stage. I don't know if I was telling them that 10 years ago, but the reason why I tell them that now is because with our iPhones now, it's so easy to not live in the moment and to live in other people's lives and other people's worlds and pop out of your own life just to go into the future, go into the past, and not be in this moment. And then if most of your life you've been kind of stuck on your phone, God bless you, Steve Jobs, but and I have an iPhone, but if you're stuck on your phone and then you put it down and then you think you're going to just perform a play and know what you're doing at all moments, that's not going to happen, because you have to, in essence, the way I live my life off stage is the way that my characters are breathing on stage.
That's the voice of Nilaja Sun, playwright, actor, solo performer, and teaching artist, speaking with me recently in studio. We turn next to a portion of a conversation I had with Tom Ross, artistic director of Aurora Theatre Company. I asked Tom how he thinks he's changed as a director over the course of the more than 24 plays he's directed at the Aurora since 1992.
Every play is a challenge because every play is different. Every cast is different. Sometimes people say, oh, that's a risky work, or that's not so risky. But I think every work is risky because it's theater. It's live. You don't know how it's going to come together ultimately. You create a little family for 3.5 weeks of usually people that don't know each other. And by the second or third day, you're talking about your sex lives or whatever, because you got to go through all that stuff as actors around a table. So you create this wonderful little family. And then 9 weeks later, it's over and everybody goes away. I remember that. I think it was a quote that Picasso said that I read a long time ago or something. And he said he was a great artist. He said, other people can paint what I paint, but I can make it look as good as they can with fewer brushstrokes. And I think my process has gotten clearer. I think I'm clearer in talking to actors about what I'm looking for from them. I am not a director that deconstructs plays. I try to do what I think the playwright is aiming for. I don't try to impose my will on an actor. What I try to do is find out what the actor's feeling and experiencing and make sure that it's making sense in the world that I create. I create the world of the play on stage, but the actors have to create their own individual bubbles of what they're doing. I don't have that line memorized in my head. I'm not looking at that other actor in the eyes. They're doing that, but I can see it from the outside. And I want to make sure that what they're doing on stage is what they believe in. And they're not just doing it because Tom told them to. And so I think I've gotten less egotistical about that, you know, stuff, and just clearer in my approach. And I also know our room so well. Because, yes, I've not only directed 25 or 26 shows in that room or the same configuration at the City Club, but as artistic director, I'm with every other director during their previews, during their rehearsals, and I'm giving them notes as well. So I think my understanding of the deep thrust is sometimes I want to do a proscenium show just to do something different. But I think I understand our space really well.
And when you're trying to elicit something from an actor, are you telling that actor typically, think about this or imagine that? Or is there some other way in which you try and nudge the actor in a direction that you want?
Well, I always start with a number of days of table work. That's where we just sit around with the script and we start breaking things down into little components and start looking at it there in the early stages. Like, why is that character saying that? What is that chess move that character's just made? Why is that character reacting? Why is there a silence or a pause there? And we start going very, very deeply into that. So I think we usually start on the right foot to begin with. I don't think I'm a method actor director that I'm saying invoke some horrible thing that happened to you when you were a child. Although I think some actors do that privately, but I don't impose that on them. We talk about the script and talk about what the playwright's writing there. And I think I've been really lucky. I've had a lot of great actors who know how to bring up the tears or know how to bring up the anguish or the pain without me telling them. Like I said, I'm actually protective of some of the actors in my current cast because I think that they're dredging up some really deep things and I don't want them hurting themselves.
That's Tom Ross speaking with me in September 2017. I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Next up is an actor named Emily Jean Brown. I interviewed Emily after seeing her perform at the Aurora in a play by Sarah Burgess called Dry Powder. In Dry Powder, sparks fly when two principals of a private equity firm disagree on what to do with a company that the firm plans to acquire. Emily played the role of Jenny, one of the principals, and the play was directed by Jennifer King. Here's a portion of my conversation with Emily Jean Brown. So if I were you, if I were in your position, I would be tempted to see Claire Danes, who played the character you played, that you are playing in the 2016 production of Dry Powder at New York's Public Theater, to see how she did it and how she portrayed Jenny. I don't know if there's a video of that production available, but were you tempted to check her out? And if so, did you check her out? And kind of what are the consequences for an actor in terms of seeing someone else play that character, the same character?
Yeah, I think my initial thought was I was curious. And, you know, I am familiar with her work in film and TV, of course. So, you know, when I first got the role, I would tell people, oh, I'm playing the Claire Danes role, you know. So I had a sense of what her acting style is as I approached this. But I think I don't know if there's a video. If there is, I haven't seen it. But, you know, I think for me, creatively, in my best interest is to try to set that aside, at least in the beginning stages of approaching a character, and really try to just, as I said, just sort of take it in non-judgmentally from the page and try not to be too influenced by previous performances or interpretations. I did read the reviews. I did read the reviews of the New York production, and yeah, that was interesting. But it's, you know, you have to be careful with how much you take in at the very beginning, because you want to really be involved in your process, your individual process, and your collaboration with the people that are in the room with you.
So you were saying earlier about kind of learning maybe not to carry judgments of your character into the production and just to try and inhabit Jenny as you found her on the page. As a young actor, you know, I think you graduated from the MFA program at American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco just last year, right? Is there something else that you kind of learned about acting and the art of acting and the craft of acting from this particular production with this group of people?
This has been the first opportunity that I've had to do a play since I graduated from ACT's MFA program. So I think what's been really exciting for me is seeing all the ways that my training has really informed my artistic approach, has informed my artistic, my aesthetic, and my values sort of as a creative. You know, acting is such an interesting art form because our medium is our being. It's our body, it's our voice, it's a human being inhabiting another human being, or blending with another human being, or, you know, portraying another human being. And so figuring out how much of myself to bring into a character like this, or to trust that the casting was done properly by these people. And as soon as I read the character and started to understand her, I was able to identify, oh, this is why they cast me in this role, right? I'm very different as a person from this person, but there are things about her that I just naturally, without even trying, bring into a room as Emily. And so figuring out, well, where do I need to just trust that I have this as part of who I am? I don't have to push for those things. And then where do I have to find the things that we layer on through my physical training, through my breath training? You know, when I come into a room, I'm grounded. People feel like, you know, even when I'm feeling nervous or shaky, people tend to give me the feedback that I seem grounded and I seem, you know, so I'm a rooted presence. So I have that. The way that I speak, I think I look kind of like a young ingenue, and then I open my mouth and people are like, oh, this is an intelligent woman. That's mm-hmm. something that Jenny also has, right? But then the wonderful thing about the process is Jennifer allowed, I told her, I said, you know, this is a very severe character. And I know that in some of the reviews, she was very icy in that original production. She was kind of like very severe and almost robotic. And so I told Jennifer, for my process, I think it would be useful for me to get the opportunity to go through the play on both extremes, to like go through it one time just as a total robot ice queen, and then go through it another time with just the ability to cry or scream or just be emotionally out of control in a way that Jenny would probably never be within the world that Sarah has set up for us. So Jennifer really gave me the opportunity to like layer on those different things, and we would, toward the end of the process, we would fine tune it and sort of dial up the emotion and then dial it back and then maybe bring in a physical constriction and then loosen it up again. And so we kind of pushed it all over the Richter scale until we got to a place where we felt like this is both me bringing Emily to the role, but it's also the craft that we've found together in rehearsal. And I think the ability to ask that of my director and to know that that's what I need in my process is something that I absolutely that I gained during my time at ACT, and that now through this process has been solidified and sort of validated for me creatively.
The actor Emily Jean Brown speaking with me in studio this past July. You are listening to highlights from interviews I've conducted about theater, the craft, the mechanics, the intellectual and creative and collaborative work involved in turning a script into a stage production. We hear next from the actor Jackie Chung, who I spoke with after seeing Office Hour, a play by Julia Cho that was staged at Berkeley Rep. Jackie played a writing professor named Gina, who speaks to a troubled student named Dennis, who, in the view of Gina's colleagues, fits the profile of a mass shooter. Dennis was played by another Asian-American actor, Daniel Chung. This excerpt of my interview with Jackie Chung begins with her talking about the value of after-show talkbacks, where audience members interact with theater staff, with the actors sometimes sitting on stage or watching from a booth.
These talkbacks have been really incredible. Some people share a lot. And I know that Julia wrote this play hoping that it could provide healing for some people. And I think for a lot of people, seeing this on stage and seeing these characters, either as educators or as students, it seems has been helpful. And also, what has been lovely for me to see, as I watch from the booth creepily, is that there have been a good number of Asian American audience members. And without fail, there will be at least one who says that it is so heartening to see these two characters on stage, that how I felt reading the play is how they feel seeing it, that I don't often see Asian American people on stage. I don't see Asian American people in these kinds of roles. And also expressing feelings that I have been feeling. That came up a lot. Like the words that Dennis says, people have said, those are the exact thoughts that I've had. So that has been really powerful.
And what is it like to almost every night play someone who's super nervous and wary and yet compassionate and trying to reach out to another human being? What's that like just kind of emotionally for you as an actor, as someone who has this kind of routine, but the routine is a very tense and dramatic one?
People have often asked about that. Is how do you get through the play? We had an... a friend of a friend come and he said, do you just carbo load just to keep your energy up? And I said, no, but I should do that. I keep thinking in my mind that because I'm here with my son and my husband isn't here, so I just go home and it's like I cannot even think about the play. I'm just thinking about dinner. I'm thinking about the next day. So I feel like I can let it go. But after several months of doing this play, I've had a lot of neck and back pain.
Oh.
So I have come to realize that I'm pushing it out of my mind and pushing it into my body.
Right.
So it is taking its toll. It's a lot to hold that much tension in your body for so long. I do feel like both of our characters do have moments of release, and that helps. But just from a technical actor side of things, I'm just stretching, finding times to relax and sit. So we are definitely taking care of ourselves, or trying to.
Yeah, and perhaps people would think, well, it's a routinized thing, right? So you know what you're going to do every night or try to do every night. And so that might take the load off in terms of the emotion and the commitment you need to make. But I guess you are fully trying to inhabit that character every night. And so every night anew, you are experiencing those things that your character is experiencing.
Yes. I mean, as actors, we try to be in the moment as much as we can. Even though you know where you need to be, you're still trying to be as alive in every moment as you can. And, you know, obviously there's a script, but, you know, sometimes Daniel turns his head differently towards me or at a different moment, you know, and in order to keep this live and fresh, I have to keep looking for those. So it's always going to change. It's never going to be quite the same.
So I got the script after I saw the play, and it begins, the script begins with the following quote by Hallmar or Jalmar Soderbergh. The quote goes like this: "People want to be loved, failing that, admired, failing that, feared, failing that, hated and despised. They want to evoke some sort of sentiment. The soul shudders before oblivion and seeks connection at any price." So this is what someone reading this play sees at the very beginning, before anything happens, before any characters are introduced. What's your sense of what those words mean in the context of this play?
I mean, it really is true, I think, about human beings. You do want to connect. You don't want to live in isolation. And I think both characters, actually, of Gina and Dennis, are probably feeling that way in that moment.
That's the actor Jackie Chung. She joined me in studio in March of this year. We'll take a short music break and return with more excerpts of interviews about theater and life. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. As I mentioned at the beginning of this hour, I wear another hat, that of associate theater critic. In that capacity, I interview playwrights, actors, directors, and other performers, and today we're presenting excerpts from some of those conversations. Now, some theater companies are overtly in-your-face political. The San Francisco Mime Troupe produces plays that highlight progressive and radical ideas and struggles. When I sat down earlier this year with Michael Jean Sullivan, longtime Mime Troupe member and veteran playwright, actor, and director, I asked him about the historical context of the Mime Troupe's most recent production, Seeing Red, a time-traveling musical. Michael gave me this history lesson.
There was a period after the Civil War when the robber barons, as we study them in history books, the robber barons were kind of controlling everything. They were buying up railroads. They were buying up the land around the railroads. They controlled the gold supply in the United States. They controlled all the banking. And people were becoming more and more desperate. The Industrial Revolution was finally happening in the United States. Workers had zero rights. They could be worked to death. Children were working in the mines. Farmers were being pushed off their land. And this progressivism started up. After the revolutions that had happened in Europe and 1848, this idea of, well, maybe what's best for the rich isn't best for everybody. Maybe these people are just living off us like these giant leeches stuck on the workers of the world. And so different organizations and proto-unions, because unionism was very, very new, all these organizations, these workers' friendship or benevolent societies and stuff, started working towards changing the economics of the United States and saying it should be the vast wealth and abundance in this country should benefit those who are actually creating it, not just those who already have enough money to invest in its creation.
What happened to those organizations, that movement's efforts?
That movement continued to grow and legislation changed and unions started to being formed, but there was always a huge amount of repression through the corporate government in the 1880s and 90s and continued. Always this giant pushback. But there was a point when there was all this amazing progressivism around before and right after, especially after World War I, but also before World War I, where socialists were running for president, like Eugene Debs, you know, prairie progressivism. Kansas used to be known as one of the most progressive states in the United States. Yeah, what happened? All of these people who saw that they had to look beyond fear and beyond race and beyond national boundaries to really say what's good for the workers, what's good, and the workers and farmers having a relationship rather than being set at it. Like right now, we live in a time where the cities, it's the cities against the farmers, you know, when they have so much in common. So workers and farmers coming together and trying to change the kind of the definition of the United States from a capitalist country to a country that has capital but uses it for everyone. Democratic socialism. What happened to the socialists and progressivism after World War I, to a large extent, was they got co-opted by the Democratic Party. The Democrats said, well, we'll change enough stuff. And they had to when it came to, you know, after the crash and the Great Depression, they had to come up with something, you know, the New Deal, basically to keep there from being a revolution. Because there were huge marches. We never hear about that in our history books. We never hear about the huge socialists and communist marches and the demand for change and all the different political parties, the Prairie Progressivist Party and, you know, the Democratic Socialist and, you know, all of these different parties that we have. We think of this as a two-party system, but there were all of these very progressive parties. But eventually all of that got co-opted by the Democrats. Some of them, you know, very enthusiastically, but for a large extent, it was just, here are the little crumbs that we can flick off our table to the workers. We'll still be super rich, but we can flick these crumbs off and the workers will think these are banquets because they've had nothing before this. So, but now that even the New Deal is very much under threat. And the Great Society, Medicare, Social Security, unemployment benefits, all of this stuff. So we're at this point again where will the workers accept the crumbs? If somebody says, we're going to cut Medicare completely, and then they decide to not cut Medicare completely, that's a crumb. They should be expanding Medicare. It's our tax dollars, you know. It's like, oh, we're going to cut funding for schools to make them more efficient, and we're going to make sure that we have charter schools, because charter schools make money for someone. That's the only difference. They generally speaking, their test scores are lower, but somebody gets rich from a charter school. It's not better. It's just somebody gets rich. But they'll say, well, we'll give you all waivers. We'll give you all these things so that your kid can go to a charter school. They're getting rich. We're getting a crumb. But at least the school didn't close. We should be demanding more.
And here, Michael Gene Sullivan points to a key orientation and outlook of the San Francisco Mime Troupe, while also offering a critique of discourses that focus solely on race.
One of our traditions is we always write for the world. And because we're doing that, we always want to make sure that our collective and our acting body represents the world. So we're, you know, multiracial, multigenerational, you know, we have all of these, you know, these wonderful performers, and we make sure to write for a view of the world that either we want to see or we feel is actually the world that doesn't get reflected, you know. So often plays are very much siloed. It's that white family over there or this black family over there. And if that white family and black family intersect, it's only about race, you know. And it's not about working class issues. It's not about the environment. So the Mime Troupe's always trying to say, no, the world is a bigger place than you think it is. The world is a more diverse place than you think it is. Everybody who isn't white doesn't walk around always thinking, I'm black or I'm Asian. That's not the first thing on our minds. We have other issues. And so to try to show the commonality of the working class. And so that's always a very strong thing in our plays.
Michael Gene Sullivan, veteran member of the San Francisco Mime Troupe. We move now to the theater arts professor and director Daryl V. Jones, who I spoke to after seeing a play called The Royale, written by Marco Ramirez and directed by Jones at Aurora Theater. The play was loosely based on the life and times of Jack Johnson. I asked Daryl V. Jones who Jack Johnson was and what he did.
Jack Johnson was the first African-American heavyweight boxing champion, a title that he won in 1910. And Jack was a rather controversial figure. There's actually a play that was written about him in the 1970s called The Great White Hope that starred James Earl Jones and Jane Alexander. That one focused on his relationship, he had a penchant for having relationships with white women, which at the time in 1910 was unheard of. I mean, this was a time when African-American men were still being lynched daily throughout the South. And Jack Johnson was a man who lived by his own rules. He was a man who was truly true to himself. So he was the first African-American heavyweight boxing champion. He did this in the midst, he attained this in the midst of a great deal of racism being thrown at him. He was called, you know, the vicious black brute, nothing more than an animal. This was also when, at a time in our history when minstrelsy was the primary form of entertainment, of popular entertainment in this country, were the minstrel shows. And the minstrel shows were filled with caricatures and stereotypes that evolved during slavery and then were further evolved during Reconstruction to put fear of the African American in the minds of the predominant culture. And certainly the most insidious stereotype from that era that remains to this day is that of the vicious black brute, the one who is designed to rape white women and is threatening and carries switchblades and daggers and is just nothing more than an animal. So Jack Johnson faced daily in the news and you know, going on trains and hotels, he faced those kind of slurs and racist attacks constantly just for being a black man. Now, when you add onto that that he was also dating white women, he was truly a revolutionary, but he was considered dangerous by whites and blacks alike because he was upsetting the apple cart. He wasn't being a good Negro. He was being himself. And that raised a lot of eyebrows at the time.
So on July 4th, 1910, Jack Johnson boxed a white man named Jim Jeffries for the title. Jeffries was champion from 1899 to 1905. And Jeffries, am I correct, came out of retirement to box Jack Johnson.
That's correct, yes. And that took some convincing because Jack Johnson had to fight hundreds of men prior to Jim Jeffries to convince the boxing world that he was worthy of the title. But most of the white boxers refused to fight him because at that time they wanted to make sure that any heavyweight or any title was reserved strictly for the white men. And so for Jim Jeffries to come out of retirement, it also meant that he was, and the whole race was going to possibly face the outcome of an African-American man beating him. And that would totally destroy the idea of the white supremacy, even the physical supremacy of whites over African Americans. Now, prior to the Jeffries fight, he did have a fight in Australia, and I cannot remember that gentleman's name, and he beat him in Australia, and actually they had to turn off the cameras. They turned off the cameras and stopped filming because they didn't want to acknowledge that he was actually winning. A lot of these fights actually were filmed, and they were sent around the country. People would go to the movies to watch these fights, and oftentimes his were not even shown in the Southern movie theaters. People were not ready for an African-American to defeat a white man at that point in time.
Later in that interview, I asked Daryl about the mindset and emotional state of the character Jay in the play The Royale. Jay is similar in many respects to the real-life Jack Johnson.
I think what goes through his mind, it probably also went through Jack Johnson's mind, because some of this is based on what really happened. So what Jay starts to face in the plot of this play, which reveals the last few months leading up to the fight, is he starts to face fear. And when I first read the play, I also said, wow, this has incredible resonance today, because whenever an African-American, traditionally when an African-American has gone beyond what the predominant culture believes that an African-American should do, there's always some kind of repercussion. Sometimes those repercussions have been violent. Other times they manifest in other ways. The parallel that I see today is that for 8 years we had an African-American president, and all the time there was this anger that brewing underneath. And then when we had the election last year, we got to see that there was a repercussion. That might be simplifying it, you know, a bit, but that's how I saw it when I first read the play. So for Jay, what's revealed to him in the course of the play is that there are people that want to bring him down. There are people that want to stop him. And on another level, what's revealed to him is that if you do this, you are putting your fellow African Americans' lives in danger, because there will be repercussions. And there were. There were riots when Jack Johnson won. I know that at least the number 20 is sticking in my mind. At least 20 people were killed across the country. So he has to deal with wanting to break the barrier, at the same time, though, not wanting to endanger the lives of his loved ones and others. There's a famous quote that was said about him at the time, and I'm going to slaughter the quote, I'm sure, but it was something to the effect of, it's better for him to win and have there be casualties than for him to lose and not move the entire race forward.
That's Daryl V. Jones. He spoke with me in studio in November 2017. He is, among other things, professor of theater at Cal State East Bay. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We've got two more voices for you. The next one belongs to Gregory Dawson, an award-winning choreographer and founder and artistic director of Dawson Dance SF. Here's an excerpt of a conversation I had with Gregory Dawson. Now, Gregory, I don't go to a lot of dance performances, and I always like to, when I do something, I like to do it right. So I don't know whether you've been asked this before, but what does or what should an audience member, an informed audience member, do at a dance performance? Is there something he or she should look for or concentrate on in order to get the most out of what they're seeing?
I think first and foremost is not to have expectations. Come into the process open, heart open, receiving, and just let the moment happen, you know, and let it take you to a space where you can enjoy it. You know, often you asked the question earlier about what the pieces, though I don't work in the narrative, what I think the piece is about. I don't really like to talk about that, because it's about a lot of things, but I'm really most interested in the interpretation that people have of the piece. Oftentimes people have these interpretations that I have never even thought of before, and that for it to get to that place, it really invigorates me and really takes me to a deeper place. And out of that information, a lot of things come out of that connection and correspondence.
And finally, as you create these performances, as you conceptualize them and choreograph them, do you feel like you have to grab the audience from the start? I mean, do you feel a kind of pressure to present something that not only satisfies you, but makes an immediate impression on viewers so that they get and stay engaged?
I feel a pressure to elevate the form, the art form. I'm constantly challenging myself to create work that is thought-provoking, invigorating. So I don't particularly worry about the presentation of the work because I trust myself that I will get there. I always want to inform people and give them something to hold on to. For me, composition is very important and that it flows in a way that is inviting, heartfelt, invigorating, aspirational, inspirational, fluid. I don't really worry about pleasing people.
Gregory Dawson is a former Lines ballet dancer, and he's the artistic director of Dawson Dance SF. That's part of an interview I did with Gregory in January 2017. The final set of insights we have for you today comes from L. Peter Callender. He is a veteran actor, director, and writer, and he's the artistic director of African American Shakespeare Company. Peter joined me in studio to discuss, among other things, a play he directed at the Aurora, a play by the South African writer Athol Fugard called Master Harold and the Boys. Here's a portion of my interview with L. Peter Callender. You know, a lot of people, Peter, would not associate African Americans with Shakespeare. They wouldn't think about Blacks and Shakespeare together. Is that a lack of imagination, or is it something else?
It's both. It's yeah. You know, we were just talking about Fugard, and just one more quick thing, because we did say Shakespeare. Fugard, in his company with the Serpent Players, they did lots of Shakespeare. From Othello to Titus Andronicus. They did the Greeks. They loved Sophocles. He did lots of Antigone. So when people say, well, black actors doing Shakespeare, like Hallie says in the play, what does a black man know about making a kite? Everyone has these ideas that we are not allowed. We can't fly a kite. We don't know about those. That's a white person thing. We can't do ballet. That's a white person thing. We can't sing opera. It is wrong. It is insensitive. It's ridiculous. I guess I can come up with some other phrases, but I won't. Look, I've been doing Shakespeare. I've done 27 of Shakespeare's plays over the years. It is one of the playwrights that I understand intrinsically. It's deep in my DNA. I love his work. Some of the best actors that I have worked with on Shakespeare have been black actors and black actresses. There's something about the topic. There's something about Shakespeare as a political writer. There's something about Shakespeare as a race writer, certainly in Othello, certainly in Merchant of Venice, Midsummer Night's Dream, where one of the characters talk about because I am dark. He's written all these incredible plays that anyone that has an understanding about life, anyone that cares about life, should do. It's not a matter. It's not a white world as far as Shakespeare is concerned. White, black, yellow, tall, short, Asian. It doesn't matter. I think it's just what comes from the heart.
Do you see the African American Shakespeare Company as being part of a genealogy, as following other previous efforts to bring African Americans to Shakespeare, whether it's in the realm of acting or viewing?
Let me say this. A man whose life I emulate, who was a great political mover and shaker in the world, Paul Robeson, in whom I share an historical footnote, as a matter of fact, a theatrical historical footnote, one of the greatest black Shakespeare actors. There's a wonderful book by Eric Hill called Shakespeare in Ebony. Beautiful book. I believe that's the title. Ira Aldridge, recently played by Carl Lumley, directed by Margot Hall, in a play called Red Velvet, done at San Francisco Shakes. He played Othello in London and was almost booed off the stage because he was a black actor playing Othello, which was uncalled for. It was, you know, white actors only played these roles.
How long ago was this about?
This is in the 30s, I believe. So their early leadership brought us to the point where we can say this: we can own Shakespeare. We can make it our own. We can tell these stories through our own eyes and tell them well, if not better, than other theater companies and other parts of the world. That we can say we can take ownership of that. And I think Shakespeare would be very proud of that, because I do believe that Shakespeare, not I believe, it is a fact, that Shakespeare wrote most of his plays for the people. It was written certainly for the hierarchy in a certain extent because they were commissioned, but he wrote it for the people, and he wrote it for the time that these plays took place. There were contemporary audiences. So we should take Shakespeare and do them in our contemporary styles, because that's what Shakespeare did in his time. And I think there are many theater companies and many actors that have gone before us that we are saying, let's pick up the mantle at African American Shakespeare Company and highlight the fact that actors of color are capable, are knowledgeable, are excited about doing these works, and we can do it very, very well.
The voice of L. Peter Callender, Artistic Director of African American Shakespeare Company. He's also an associate artist at California Shakespeare Theater. I spoke with Peter in July 2016. And that wraps up this tour of highlights from interviews I've conducted about theater, life, and politics. I'm C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.